welcome into the newest All Ball. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and we can't tell you how much we appreciate you downloading this here podcast. Our guest for a second consecutive pod is none other than Dan Dickow, who was just a great, great basketball player, especially his last two collegiate seasons at Gonzaga. He was National Player of the Year before becoming a first-round draft pick in the NBA. On today's episode, wait till you hear kind of the ironic full-circle nature, not just of the first time he played against Washington or his first game with Gonzaga, but also an NBA game he tried to get into and end up not getting into his first year in the NCAA tournament when they went to the Sweet 16 and where he ended up being drafted. That plus offenses that you fit into, you don't fit into, the idea of a backup point guard and why he struggled with that role for certain coaches. This is good eating right here. Really, really good eating. Quick reminder, the Doug Gottlieb Show is 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, foxsportsradio.com, the iHeartRadio app. You should download this, subscribe, rate it, write a review, because when you write a review, I think I make more money. And if I don't, well, we're just going to test you for your writing acumen. That's really what it kind of comes down to. Anyway, when we last left Dan Dickow, he was discussing his transfer to Gonzaga from the University of Washington, working with Tommy Lloyd during his year off. Now we continue.
During our last episode with Dan Dickow and the car stories, we left you with Gonzaga, Tommy Lloyd, unbelievable workouts. He was a grinder. You guys became tight like butt cheeks, right? And so I guess here's I got a bunch of things that I want to get to. But how do you know you're getting better? I mean, I guess it's when I sat out, I did what you were talking about doing, which is Golden West College was coached by Tom McCluskey, who was my high school coach for my freshman year. And so I got to do like a bunch of things. One is I got to be an assistant coach during games. And then I got to kind of same thing, just be an alpha and take on different roles during practice and just try and carry a team. And I really felt myself kind of getting better. But what about, did you change your body? Did you change your diet? Was it just all in the gym? And take me through the entire process of that year.
Yeah, I did. I don't know if I necessarily changed my diet, but I did change the workout weightlifting regimen. When I was at University of Washington, our strength and conditioning coaches that were focused on basketball at that time, we were an afterthought because it was a football school. So really, I'm pretty darn sure the two strength coaches didn't even know my name the whole 2 years I was there. It's just, oh, that's that skinny young kid. And so I didn't have anything that really helped me athletically while I was at University of Washington.
It's weird. How you're describing it is weird because I'll be totally honest with you. I never saw you play in AAU, but I remember when we got ready to play you and you were a freshman and you came into Stillwater, the billing to us and to me was like, you were Pistol Pete. Like that was your reputation was like, this is a Pistol Pete Maravich type dude. He's going to come in. And when whatever minutes he gets, like he's different than the rest of those guys. And yet I obviously now 20 years later, it feels like, and I agree with you on the strength thing. Cause when I was at Notre Dame, we basically did a football strength program.
Sure. Football right? schools. Like, I mean, that's what they were.
Yeah. But it was the football schools should allow them the resource, like the Sean the resources, and maybe it's changed because I do think, like, I know Oklahoma State now, they have a basketball dedicated. Jake does a great job there. But it's interesting, like, that really affects you because I was 160 pounds when I walked into Notre Dame and I'd worked with Marv Maravich and whatever. And I was athletically really good, just needed some strength. And that was when creatine was first big.
Yeah.
And dude, I was
take you with grape juice, right?
Yeah, I was swole. I was like 177 our first game. I gained 17 pounds, but it wasn't a bad thing. Like I looked great, but I wasn't flying all over the place. And so one of the things that I did when I got back to Orange County was like I got back to get my diet right and my body right, and I looked more like a basketball player. I leaned out some. as opposed to being a weightlifter. So I was just wondering how much that played, because, and look, WCC was not at the level of the Pac-12, but you went from being a good player, you played with a broken foot when you were at Washington, to being the best player in college basketball. And I'm just, in addition to the workouts, I would assume that your body changed a little bit as well.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Because I was a kid who started getting interested in weightlifting as a sophomore in high school, but no matter what I did, I couldn't put on weight. I couldn't put on size. I couldn't put on strength. That was just, you know, the way my body was maturing. My redshirt year at Gonzaga that you're alluding to, we had a really good strength coach, but he was a former football player and he was kind of, you know, from the bodybuilding type mold. So it was a little bit of fine line of, he was still learning how to tailor it into basketball specific movements. Gonzaga now has one of the best strength coaches in the country, Travis Knight, but the former guy that I used to work with in the Elite Eight group worked with, he was all about putting on size and strength. And so I think his workouts combined with the fact that I wasn't playing games and I put a ton of effort into the weight room at that time, and then my body just finally caught up. I really started putting on some size and strength and muscle mass. I was my senior year at Gonzaga. I was a legit 190, where in high school, when I graduated, I was probably about 172. Right now to this day, I'm about 185, but when I got to the NBA, I actually lost weight. I was about 185 after I tore my Achilles. I went down to about 175 because I realized in the NBA, I wasn't going to push anybody around. It didn't matter how strong I was. What mattered to me in the NBA was my balance, the ability to take a hit and stay on the course, on the path, on the direction that I had. So that redshirt year really kind of tied in all the basketball workouts, my body maturing, and then the weight room really kind of helped as well.
Your first game back, do you remember who you played?
I remember the first preseason game. It was this was when they had these old traveling teams, right?
You
had
EA Sports and stuff.
So we played a CBA team called the Yakima Sun Kings, sure, who were a really good team in the CBA at the time. I had 29 points in the first game back, and I remember walking off that court being like, all right, I think this is going to work. And it was a lot of fun. I look back at that game, and I saw a box score a couple of years ago from that game, and David Vanterpool was on the Sun Kings, and he's kind of one of the next up-and-coming guys in the NBA who's going to be a head coach. He's been on the Blazers staff for a number of years now.
I think your first big game at GU was against Arizona. Right? You guys played Arizona.
It was one of them, yeah.
Yeah, on the road. Yeah, you played. I'm looking at your schedule. Okay, so you open up Eastern Washington. Now, was Giacoletti the coach at Eastern when you're playing?
Giacoletti was the coach that year. Everything kind of came full circle because, as we talked about in the first part, yeah, he was the guy who recruited me to UW, and now he's the head coach at Eastern. It was kind of interesting. But, you know, to kind of wrap things up even more and come full circle, Coach Giacoletti is a great friend of mine to this day. I actually texted with him the other day. He's on staff at St. Louis. Phenomenal guy. But, yeah, he was the head coach at Eastern at that time.
All right, so you busted them up. You busted up UW Green Bay. You beat Idaho by 50, running it up on poor Idaho. And so you go and play Arizona. So now, like, you're a guy who, your whole life, as we talked about part one, you dream of playing in the Pac-10, and you're at Washington, mixed results. Now you're at Gonzaga with your boys, we're a place where you're the guy, and you're a lot more comfortable. Do you remember that first matchup with Arizona?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember everything about it because, as you mentioned, it was a chance to go back and play against a Pac-10 team, and they were ranked at the time. I think so Jason Gardner was the point guard on the West Coast that, after Barron had went to the NBA, was getting a lot of the attention media-wise. So it was Jason Gardner, Gilbert Arenas, who was unbelievable. They had Michael Wright, they had Richard Jefferson, Luke Jackson, The big, tall, skinny guy, Ricky Anderson, I believe it was. They were low.
Yeah, his dad, Ricky was Ricky's dad was the coach at Long Beach City, right?
Okay.
Lauren Woods, they had.
Yeah, Lauren Woods. They were loaded, and you know everyone was still kind of on the fence with Gonzaga. Like, hey, you know they were back to backs. They went Elite Eight, Sweet 16. The guys that got them there, they're gone. It's Casey Calvary's team that we don't know about. Blake Stepp, the freshman. We don't know about Dan Dickow, the transfer from UW. So went in there with a lot of confidence, played really well, really well. I think we were up midway or late in the second half. And Casey Calvary got a phantom fifth foul call. He was nowhere near the play, nowhere near the play. It was like a loose ball in the middle of the key. Casey was about 6 to 8 feet away from the scrum, and he gets called for it. And everything just kind of went downhill from there, and we ended up losing only by about maybe six or something, if I remember right. 14. But that was a 14. Okay, well, my memory may have made it a little closer game.
It's okay. So it was probably, it gets away from you at the end, yeah, you know.
It was probably a four-point game or something when that happened, yeah, when he fouled out, and we just couldn't hang on. But the other thing that I remember about this game is so towards the end of the game, we're on offense. Somebody takes a shot, and you know how point guards, if you're on the baseline after like a driving kick and you're kind of – your momentum's taking you under the basket, a rebound happens, and you'll just take a swipe at whoever gets – yeah, but you'll take a swipe at whoever's getting the rebound. I took a swipe at the ball because Richard Jefferson was getting the rebound, and my finger stuck in his jersey, and I felt like a pop. I'm like, oh no. So I'm running down court and I'm shaking my hand, trying to make it feel better. And I was like, okay, this isn't good. So I dribbled down and this was on my left hand. So thankfully it's not my dominant hand. I'm dribbling down the floor, next possession, throw a one hand pass. Don't have to do anything else with it. Second, next possession after that, I'm coming down the floor and I have to throw a skip pass. So I pick the ball up with two hands and I throw a skip pass. And when I threw that skip pass, I heard a snap in my finger, and I looked down, and my finger's pointing in the opposite direction. because, like, after I poked at the ball with Richard Jefferson, like, it was kind of funny looking, but it wasn't awful. And so I just kept playing. So immediately we call a timeout, and I walk over to our trainer, Steve DeLong. I was like, Steve, something's wrong with my finger here. And I'm starting to, like, my arm's shaking because it hurts and something's not right. He looks at it, he goes, yeah, that's not good. Look away. I was like, what? He goes, look away. And he popped my finger back in. And he goes, all right, go ahead and go back out there. So I went out and played like the final minute and a half or whatever it might have been with a finger that was awful. So after the game, then we go to the Tucson Hospital. And I'll remember this plain as day. I'm in my jersey still. It's just me and the trainer. We go to the hospital, and you know, it's a college Division I team. You get a little bit of ahead of the line in the emergency room, right? There was somebody who was jumped in a gang fight, sitting in a wheelchair, bleeding all down his face, and Steve-O and I are like looking around and like, shouldn't you guys help this person first?
I got a bad finger, just a finger.
Yeah. So
we popped it back in. It's fine.
Yeah. We go back, get x-rays. Yeah. It's broken. Whatever. It's like, oh man, whatever. We come back out, and this is like an hour later. The kid is still sitting there in the same spot. And I was just shaking my head. It was unbelievable. It was disappointing to see that happen to a kid.
So your next game, Washington comes to town. You go back to the kennel, the old kennel, and UW comes to town. Now, at this time, Romar's the coach, right? I mean,
no.
No, Stillbender?
Stillbender, yes, Stillbender. So that was maybe my most disappointing and frustrating game that I ever missed at the college level.
Okay, wait. So just to set it up, just so you understand. So when I left Notre Dame, and unlike your experience at UW, like I don't blame them, right? I'm not. I mean, there's no. What do I wish we had any sort of transition game, secondary break? Like, were there things about Notre Dame in terms of basketball wise that I thought could have been better? Yes, And was I considering leaving even before I had to transfer? Yes. Right. I think lots of freshmen go through that. But I nearly went to Marquette, and there's a myriad of reasons. Mike Dean was the coach. He's a crazy person, but he was incredibly passionate as a recruiter. And I always dug Marquette. This is before Marquette kind of hit it big, right, with Tom Crean and them. But the big draw to me was get to play Notre Dame. I want to kick their ass.
Yeah.
Like that's, I think any competitors, like, you don't know what you had until you had it, you know, until you lost it. And I always wanted to play Notre Dame, And at the end of the day, a big reason, there's a lot of reasons I chose Oklahoma State instead of Notre Dame, but instead of Marquette. And one of the big reasons was like, I knew I was losing myself in my desire to say, fuck you. Right. That was really, I had to get kind of, what do I really need? What kind of place do I want to play at, et cetera? You leave, as you said, like, it didn't feel like they wanted you to stay, even though you were one of the biggest recruits in the West Coast when you got there, and you spend a year off. Okay. What do you remember kind of the lead up? Like, because you get so wrapped up in the Arizona game and you got the finger and now you fly home. Like, do you remember the lead up to it and what all those emotions were like?
You know, I do to some extent, but you know, the only guys that I really stayed in decent contact with from UW would have been Michael Johnson, who came in with me at the same time at UW, and then Grant Leap, who's now a head coach at Seattle Pacific. Those were the only two guys I really stayed in touch with after I decided to transfer. And so I kind of was excited to see those guys play. There was another young guy, would have been Marlon Shelton. His dad, Lonnie, played in the NBA for a while. He was a year younger than me at UW. It was nice to see him in person when they were came to Spokane to play us. But really, I didn't keep a lot of connections with those guys. And I think a lot of it probably honestly had to do with the time of technology. Now there's the social media aspect where, you know, if you're being recruited by a similar school as another kid across the country, you get to know them at an early age, direct messages, Twitter posts, Instagram, all that stuff. So it was a lot different then. And so I don't think the connections weren't necessarily there for me anymore, even though it was only a year gone by. But I think, you know, the frustration and the disappointment that I wasn't able to play was absolutely there, you know, and I can take it a step further because the following year, Doug, we played at UW. So this is my senior year. And now obviously I've proven myself. We go to Seattle and Coach Benner was still the coach, and we go to Seattle and the first two made baskets of the game, I hit back-to-back threes, bang, bang, 6 points, like literally in the first 2 minutes. And so in the back of my head, I'm thinking, I'm going to give these dudes 40 tonight. I'm going to give them 40. Well, I ended up, I don't want to blame it on the official, but I picked up, bing, 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 two quick fouls in the, right after those made threes. And then I think I picked up a third the second Coach Few put me back in the first half. Only game my senior year I was in single digits was 6 points. Every other game my senior year I was in double figures. That game right there maybe sits with me more than any other. Like, man, I wanted to give those guys 40, and I ended up with six.
Your junior year, you guys went through this little losing stretch there. You know, obviously, you know, your finger, and then you guys have this like treacherous road thing where you go and you play Florida on the road, and then you lose to Green Bay. But then you guys kind of figured it out, with the exception of Santa Clara on the road, I think. Like, once you got in the league, you didn't lose a game. You went like 13-1 plus win the conference tournament. Was there a Dan Dickow meeting that turned that thing into a Sweet 16 year?
A couple things. So you mentioned kind of a lull. So, and I take great pride in this because Coach Few always judges his point guards, not on points, not on assists, turnovers, et cetera. Did you win the game or not? Because he understands different players have different strengths, and he wants you to play within your strengths to help the team win. when I was out, we went 5-4, and that's the stretch you're talking about. If you take out those 9 games during the course of my 2 years, I think I had the highest winning percentage of any point guard that played at Gonzaga. I if not, I'd be top 2 or 3. So I take great pride in that. But on that trip that you're talking about, Florida and then up to Wisconsin, Green Bay, Gonzaga always has a culture of great leadership from their old seniors, juniors and seniors, whoever it may be. And a lot of times the leadership doesn't come from their best player or their leading scorer. We lost at Wisconsin, Green Bay after losing to Florida. And
Boise, by the way. And Boise.
And Boise. Yes. So we lost in Wisconsin, Green Bay, and Mark Spink, only true Zag fans will remember that name. Mark Spink lit everybody up in the locker room, up and down. I mean, from, you know, I was spared because I couldn't play, but I'm sitting there like, okay, I agree with everything you're saying, right? But he lit every single person up and down that locker room, from manager to teammate. And come to find out later on, the coaching staff was in the hallway. And the second they were about to come in and kind of give their pregame talk, Mark Spink just went off on us. And so Mark Spink basically just set the tone for the rest of the year. Like, guys, there's no more BSing around. It's on us. We've lost enough games. We have to get through this if we're going to get back to the NCAA tournament, which we all know we're good enough to do. We all want to do. We don't want to let this Gonzaga run end on us. And so that was the turning point. You mentioned the Santa Clara loss. That was an interesting game because we just couldn't score. We could not score. Santa Clara was really good at that time. They had some good backcourt guys. They had some really good bigs. But that game was fun for me because I had a stretch in the second half where I scored 22 straight points. Like, literally, I watched the video a few years back. Then this was the coach's film because not every Gonzaga game was on TV at the time. I had 22 straight points, and that kept us in it to some extent, but we still ended up losing that game. But yeah, those were some fun memories.
We talked in the last episode about when you're a freshman, like kind of living with some mistakes, and you wish it at Washington they would have done that. When you got hurt, Kyle Bankhead and Blake obviously had to kind of pick up the load. Is there any thought that, like, now years later, when you got hurt, they developed more, kind of threw them in the deep end, right?
Absolutely. Now,
then you. Right. I remember watching that team going like, well, that's when you beat Virginia and you get all the way to the Sweet 16. Like, maybe none of that happens if not for their development by fire, because you were out and it was during a time which you played those road games against good competition.
Yeah, you're spot on with that, because, I mean, Blake was a tremendous player as a freshman. I mean, he basically came in knowing he was going to start alongside me in the backcourt. Blake was no nonsense. All he cared about was winning. I mean, he got the outlet. He was the point guard on that possession. I got the outlet. I was the point guard on that possession. But when I got hurt, all the point guard responsibilities fell on him for that 9-game stretch. And, yeah, we lost some games, but he went through some tremendous growth opportunities. You know, you mentioned the Florida game. I remember that game sitting there on the bench, not being able to play because of my broken finger. And I think Blake had like 8 or 9 turnovers, and he struggled from the field. But he did not back down. Like, and that was a good Florida team. They had Teddy DuPay. They had Brett Nelson. Udonis Haslam was one of their bigs. I mean, they were good. And Blake, as a freshman, didn't back down. He just didn't obviously make the right play, but he was one of those guys that was headstrong and was just going to keep going until he figured things out. And then obviously he did. You know, so we gelled extremely well.
What do you remember about that NCAA tournament run?
Well, we went to Memphis, and, you know, Virginia wasn't, I don't think they respected us. You know, we came in and we took it to them in the first half. And then, you know, we kind of just hung on. We hung on in that second half after they made some big runs. Roger Mason Jr. Made some big plays down the stretch to make it close. I had a layup attempt blocked with maybe 6-7 seconds left, and Casey Calvary picked it up, put it in the bucket, and then we dodged a bullet when I think it was Roger Mason missed a three at the buzzer. So we obviously played well, but we didn't play our best in that game. So that gave us a lot of confidence going into round two. And we dodged a bullet as well in round two because Oklahoma got beat by Indiana State, which was a little bit of a – it wasn't a huge surprise, but it was a surprise. I mean, Oklahoma had a really good backcourt that year.
Hollis Price
and Quanis White, I believe it was. Yeah. Great defensive guards that, you know, they would have been really good matchup. But Indiana State won, and then, you know, we just kind of grinded out the win against Indiana State. We didn't do anything special. We didn't do anything off the charts good. We were just the better team by far. And then because I think this would have probably gone on to kind of showing you how Coach Few really wasn't kind of aware of things just yet. And we weren't Gonzaga yet. Like, we didn't pack enough stuff to go to Atlanta because, you know, I don't know if the coaches thought we were going to lose and come home or what it might be, but we get the message in Memphis is like, hey guys, we're not going back to Spokane. We're going on to Atlanta. And everyone's like, we packed for 4 days. What the heck? What are we supposed to do? So, literally, I mean, guys wore the same sweat outfits. Like, I mean, it was by the end of that NCAA tournament run, it was bad because guys were in the same outfits for.
Yeah, but you know, like, look, we, my senior year, we did that. We went from Syracuse to Buffalo or Buffalo to Syracuse. And we did the same thing. One, I only remember wearing gray Nike sweats my entire college basketball experience. Right?
Sure.
Like, I remember you get the first pair and you're like, these are amazing. You don't want to wash them because they have that. They're so soft when you first get them.
Yes.
Right. Like, don't wash them. And then finally you wash them, but then you just like live in them. And then you wait until usually right before the tournament, you get the new game shorts again because they get too short. Right. They shrink up and sometimes you get new sweats as well. So I'm not sure it would have changed your gear, but those memories and like, look, dude, you played in the league. You did a lot of incredible things. The games are amazing. I feel like the time in the NCAA tournament and the conference tournament, when it's just you and the guys and there's nothing to do, like, you know, school ain't nothing. And this is also before cell phones. So guys can't be constantly staring at their phones. Like, some guys were still headphone guys, right? With disc men, you know, whatever. But just the idea, it's just you and those guys and nothing but time to tell jokes and stories. And some guys annoy the shit out of you, right? Some guys are like way funnier than you thought. You know, there's always a manager that you pick on. There's always a manager that's kind of super cool and thinks he's super cool. There's assistant coaches that you hate. There's coaches that you like, the whole thing. That to me is the best part of the whole deal. The whole
deal. There's like, we so here's, many here's dynamics.
And okay, so I want you to I'll tell a story, and then I want you to, if you can think of one one story like this. All right. So again, this is my senior year. We're all by now like grown-ups. Like, I was 24 my senior year because I was a holdback and then I redshirted, right? So I'm oldest dirt. We're all kind of 22, 23, 24. And we win in Buffalo, and coach is like, and we should have gone home, really. We should have just gotten away from it, but we didn't. He's like, you guys want to go home for a day or stay here? And we're like, stay here, right? So we had a bus, and we went to, like, Niagara Falls, and we, you know, just kind of bullshit around and try and – anyway, we had one cassette movie for the bus, and it was something about Mary. And we watched it, I don't know, 6-7 times. And by the end, like, you know, you'd be in layup lines for a game. You're like, have you ever been to Santiago, Chile? Twice last year, right? Like, we're quoting movies as we're hooping throughout the tournament. Like, it was kind of, it became our thing. And so even we had one guy on our team who nobody liked, but even by then we're like, you know what? He's not that
He's
bad.
Okay.
Like, he kind of bought in. He kind of bought in for that, for those 2 weeks. Is there any memory you have of that tournament of Memphis to Atlanta where you guys are stuck? It's in the South. It's very different, right? You're still Gonzaga. You're still the little engine that could. Any memory you have of that trip?
Yeah. You know, we, there was the Lakers were playing the Hawks at Phillips Arena. I don't know what it's called now. And we had no connection to get tickets to the NBA game. And Jermaine Forbes, who was from London, myself and Jay Sherrill, who was, you know, from kind of just outside Seattle, they were both, the three of us were like, let's just walk down and see if we can scalp a ticket, you know, because we couldn't get free tickets or whatever. It was a Lakers, so obviously it was sold out. The two of them had never been to an NBA game. So we just, we took a taxi down to the Phillips and we were going to try to get a ticket to the game. Well, we're standing there, right? And it's connected to the CNN building and we're standing there and somebody taps me on the shoulder and says, hey, are you such and such? I'm like, yeah. I was like, what are you doing here? I'm like, well, we're going to try to get tickets to the game. He's like, well, instead of that, do you want to come? Do you mind coming up to CNN building and doing a sit down interview with Vince Cellini? I'm like, what? So we were going to go to the game instead. It ended up, the three of us went up to CNN headquarters, which was mind boggling at the time. Cause they had CNN SI and Vince Cellini and I did a little small interview. And then by the time, you know, that was over, you know, we didn't get into the game cause there was no tickets left. And we also didn't want to break the rules. Like, can we accept a free entrance to a game? So, that was kind of a unique little story, you know, during the NCAA tournament, just three random dudes. Cause Jay and I weren't close friends. Jermaine and I were not close friends. Obviously we were good friends cause we were teammates, but you know, we just wanted to go sneak into an NBA game.
Yeah, it's amazing. That reminds me of like when I was in Russia, I had this guy, Sergei Chukalkin, was like our best player. And my first trip to Moscow, like I didn't speak a word of Russian and he didn't speak English. And he comes up to me, like we get off the plane and goes, McDonald's? And I was like, yes, let's go, McDonald's. And I just followed him around Moscow. He took me to McDonald's, right? Like it's the same thing. Okay, so... the whole thing is fascinating to me about the perception that most of America has and the reality of what it's really like in big time college basketball. I'm not disputing that there are a portion of guys who get money and that they'll, you know, that they skate the rules, or whatever. I operate under the presumption that GU is not like that. I've never had any whisper of anything. When I played at two schools, it wasn't like that. And we used to kind of take it as a point of pride, right? Like you play against teams you think are dirty. And it was like, we do things the right way. We get up at 6 a.m. and run. Was that a point of pride for Gonzaga? And it wasn't just that you guys built it, but you built it by everybody's estimation the right way.
Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah. I can, you know, look you straight in the face on this Zoom call and say, nobody got any type of special treatment at Gonzaga when I was there and nobody has gotten any since. I mean, and that just speaks to the level of expectations and the level of class that Coach Few runs that program with. You know, the biggest difference between when I was there and now is the amount of gear that Nike gives those guys. It's like, good Lord, this is ridiculous. You talked about the sweats to start the season. My redshirt year, Doug, I had hand-me-down sweats that were a size too small. And if you can believe that they were a size too small, I'm only 6 foot. And so I went from hand-me-down sweats my redshirt year. My senior year, finally Nike started sending shoes in multiple shipments throughout the season. So I was taken care of fine. Now you look at what these guys have. You'll go into the locker room. And dude's got like 8 pairs of shoes in their lockers. Like they've got probably 12 dry fit shirts. They're geared up like an NBA team, right? I mean, it's like, hey, Tommy, be Mike, throw me some gear. And I obviously with COVID can't get down to practice and kind of, you know, pitch him hell for not having the latest gear. But it's like, holy cow, what don't these programs have now?
Real quick, favorite hoop shoes you've ever hooped in?
Ooh. You know, I think the Kobe 5s were pretty darn good. The Jordan, the patent leather ones, I wore those.
I wore those at prom.
My senior year.
I wore those.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I had the all white ones in college. I wore those, and my family got me the black ones with the bright red for Christmas last year. And I've only worn them once. And my kids are like, why don't you wear those more? My son, who's 14, he gets it. He's like, take care of those, Dad. Everyone else is like, how come you don't wear them? I was like, well, you know,
mine's 11. And I got those for him like 3-4 years ago. And all of a sudden now he wants a sneaker collection, you know?
Yeah.
And he's like, Dad, I'm sorry. I didn't know you got me some cool kicks. Do you still have those? It's like, nah, man, your mom gave those away. You said you didn't like them. And I was like, he's like, I was crazy. I didn't know. I'm so sorry. I was like, all right. You were like 7 at the time. Like, what am I going to do? Your senior year is fascinating to me because you pretty much balled out. Like, my memory of it was you dominated college basketball. Like, you're the best player. It was must see TV. But what's interesting about it is it started bad. It ended bad, right? You lost to Illinois. First game of the year, you lost to Wyoming. You were badly underseeded and you lost to Wyoming in the pit. So now, years later, and I'm sorry I'm bringing up bad memories, but like all that's good. How our minds work, right? Now, years later, do you think of all the amazing nights, right? And all the wins and all the dudes you gave it to? Or do you ever get trapped in the losses?
A little of both, to be honest with you. You know, going into that senior year, I knew that I was going to have a chance to have a really good year. I played for USA Basketball in the World University Games right beforehand. I struggled during that tournament, and I think it kind of lit a fire under me even more in the preseason to make sure that I was prepared and ready to go to have a great year. And you mentioned, you know, the opening season loss. We went to Illinois, and Frank Williams was another one of those kind of solid point guards that was getting a lot of recognition. I played well, but they were just bigger and better than us that day. We ended up, I think we at one point we had like a winning streak that season. It was with San Diego, who was really good at the time. You know, had a couple really nice non-conference wins, in particular St. Joe's. We beat them at the buzzer, not off the buzzer, in the last 10 seconds of the game when they had Jameer Nelson, Delonte West, Marvin O'Connor. They were really good. That was the year before, I believe, they were 31-0 or whatever it was to start the season. But, yeah, you mentioned that Wyoming game. And to this day, I can honestly say that was the most disappointing loss, one of two most disappointing losses in my career. The other would have been a high school state semifinal game, but the Wyoming game, I mean, you got to be kidding me. The NCAA tournament selection committee, who years later, I found out the Arizona AD was kind of heading it up. And I don't know how badly I want to put this out there, but I heard that he wanted Gonzaga put in their place. From secondhand sources. So I don't know how direct that is, but he wasn't happy about Gonzaga kind of continuing to build their profile. So we're ranked 6th in the country and we get a sixth seed for the 6th ranked team in the country. Not only that, we have to go play a conference champion in Wyoming at a gym that is at elevation like their school, and a gym that's in their conference, New Mexico. Like, that wouldn't happen these days with even more eyes on the NCAA tournament than what there was, you know, 20-some years ago. So, you know, I do sound bitter and frustrated. It's because I am. That was the worst draw that I can remember in the NCAA tournament, either being around or really kind of looking at me like, wow, that one's weird. You know, so that being said, that was a bad draw. But at the end of the day, we played our worst game of the year by far. Worst game of the year by far. I think Blake and I, we both struggled. I think I was like 6 of 21 or something from the field. Blake, I don't even think was that good. We both struggled. I think as a team, we shot, you know, upper 20s, low 30s from the field, and we still had a chance to win. We were still in the game in the final minute. And we had played our worst game of the year, and then, you know, we just couldn't get it done. That's that to this day, I have not watched that game in its entirety.
Blake was one of 13. You were 7 of 24. You're 7 of 24.
Yeah, neither one.
And Corey was 5 of 14.
Yeah. What was Roni? Because Roni would have been a freshman, but he wasn't quite ready.
He played 22 minutes. He was 1 of 3.
Okay. And that was big simply because that Wyoming team had some dudes. They had some big guys on the interior. Josh Davis, who went on to play a few years in the NBA, he was really good. And then they had – I'm drawing a blank on their on the big guys' names. They had two big Nigerians.
Sanwu Amade was one of them. And then they had the little guards were Jay Strait and Marcus Bailey. Like they had a good little squad there. Like that was one of those confluence of you guys. It wasn't just that you were underseeded, but the Mountain West was underseeded for a long time. The Mountain West would get, my brother was at San Diego State and they were like, dude, are you kidding me? Like we got to play like our conference champion has to play Gonzaga. Like that didn't make sense to them, let alone to you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's thanks for bringing that one, Doug.
I do what I can. Look, sure. Dude, I mean, almost all of us lose our last game, you know?
Yeah, and, right.
And, you know, the seeding thing is, I mean, hell, with my first year in the tournament, we were picked last and we end up winning the Big 12 South. We get a bye and we lose to Texas, who's a 10 seed in the Big 12 tournament. And we get like an 8 seed and we got Duke in the second game. You know, so we beat George Washington, who's good. They had Shante Rogers. And then we played Duke and, you know, game's tied. Two and a half minutes to go. I call a timeout. We did have a timeout, but it was our last timeout because I couldn't. My coach was making a sign that we didn't have signs for plays, and he's doing this. And I don't even know what you're talking about. So I call a timeout. We run a play. Our best player got three open looks and just missed them. So I know the bad seating and then how close it is. And then look, my last game, we could not have played worse. We played that same Florida team you talked about only the year before. Mm-hmm. And they have, like, if you go back and look, they had, like, Matt Bonner, Udonis Haslam, Mike Miller. I mean, they had just – Justin Hamilton became a second-round pick. They had just dudes. But our game plan was shitty. We played shitty. We had some dudes that were sick and became sick, whatever. But it just – it sucks. So here's why I wanted to get to that game. I think of all the memories I have in sports – and there's a lot of strong ones. One of the most emotional ones is being in Syracuse, New York, in one of those locker rooms and looking around at a bunch of guys and realizing I'm never going to play with them again. And how much I truly care about them as people and players and how unbelievable the experience is and how long it seems at the time. Like, you know how it is in college basketball. You're like, fuck, I got to go to practice again. Like, it's cold out. Like, I don't want to see them, you know, or the film session or, you know, scatter report. Like, dude, I know what they run. I've done this enough. And then it's over. Like it's, you wake up. I mean, you experience this in the Sweet 16. You're thinking about the final, it's over. Do you remember in the pit after that game, what that feeling was like? Cause you had like, again, I cannot undersell as much how great a year you had. But then there's that feeling of, I'm never going to do this with these guys again. Will you truly care about?
Yeah, it was crushing. I remember, you know, with, I don't know, 15 seconds left or whatever on the game clock and other team, Wyoming shooting free throws and Kyle Bankhead, who you had mentioned earlier, he was my roommate my senior year. I think Corey Violette was my roommate on the road, but Kyle Bankhead was one of my roommates back in Spokane. He's now assistant coach at UNC Greensboro, kind of working his way up the coaching path. But I remember game is basically over. 15 seconds are left. While shooting free throws, he puts his arm around me, and tears are just streaming down my face because it's like, dude, it's over. Just like you mentioned, like in an instant, it's over. You know, you work so hard. You put all the time and effort and energy and passion into having the best career, having the best season that you can have. And then the disappointment, because I knew I didn't have a great game and I knew we didn't have a good game and how much it meant to all of us to kind of advance in the NCAA tournament, not just the first round, but as far as possible. Gonzaga at that point, we still were, I don't think we weren't true Final Four worthy type of program. But we believed it that year, without a doubt. We believed it. And so, and that's the biggest thing in sports as well as in anything in life. If you believe it, you can go out and achieve it. But, you know, it was just crushing to lose that game and then walk up the long tunnel rampway there and get in the locker room. And just remember in the, you know, I don't remember what Coach Few said. I don't remember what Coach Greer said, but I just remember just a completely crushed and defeated group of guys. Like, we couldn't believe that it just ended. A magical season just ended the way it had. But you're right. I mean, you walk out of that locker room and all of a sudden, you know, you're no longer a college basketball player. And for me, I was like, wow, okay, well, you know, it does look like I'm going to be going to the NBA. My dad at the time had kind of started talking to some agents and trying to kind of prepare me to make a decision in those regards. But, you know, he wanted me to talk about it like that night. I'm like, dude, what are you talking about? We just lost. Give me some time. So, you know, it was, you know, those are some bittersweet moments, but definitely a crushing feeling when you know it's over because it meant so much.
How did you pick your agent?
So as I had mentioned, my dad at the time, kind of whittled it down to about five alongside conversations with Coach Few of who they felt was really good. And after that, it was going to be on me to make the decision, with input from my fiance, who is now my wife. So came down to, Mark Bartlestein, who ended up being my agent all my years later. I'm still with his agency who represents me on the broadcasting side or coaching if I ever go that path. And then I talked to Bill Duffy at length a number of times. He was a finalist. I talked to Aaron Goodwin. And met with him a number of times who was one of the biggest agents at the time right around there. He had Jamal Crawford, Damon Stoudemire, Gary Payton. He was the guy who had LeBron coming out of high school. Arn Tellem and Bob Myers were the other tandem that I kind of was down to. And it's an interesting and unique selection process because at the end of the day, they can all offer you almost the same thing. You know, they all, if they're as respected as that group was, they're all going to basically get the same intel from front offices. They're going to get you in the same workouts with teams leading up to the draft. They're all going to help you prepare as best you can. At that point, it just comes down to who are you most comfortable with? Who do you think has your back more than other guys? And, you know, Bill Duffy had also signed Jay Williams that year. And I kind of felt like, okay, well, we're two point guards. He's probably going to push inside with Jay Williams if there's any marketing opportunities come about. You know, same thing with you know, some of those other guys. I just felt like Mark Bartlestein gave me his word that year I was going to be the only point guard that he was going to represent in the draft. I trusted him. I looked at the track record of guys that he had in the draft up until then, guys that kind of fit my – you know, I don't want to say character, but fit my kind of mold of about what type of player I would be in the NBA. And so I decided to go with him and it was a great choice.
Okay. So I kind of, ironically, you couldn't get into the Hawks game because you didn't have a ticket and you go and do an interview with Vince Cellini.
Yeah.
And fast forward 2 years later and you're a rookie with the Hawks. And now you don't actually have to ask for tickets. They give you tickets. What was it like? Like what first, what's it like when you see your name selected? And I know you knew you were going to be selected.
Yeah.
What is that actually like?
Exhilarating, to be honest with you. So choose Bartlestein as my agent, move back to Chicago to continue to prepare to work out and use that as a home base to travel to NBA team workouts before the draft. Now, I could have stayed in Spokane, but I mean, think about it. Say yeah. I've got a pre-draft workout with say the Celtics or the Raptors. Do you want to fly from Chicago and go there? Or do you want to fly from Spokane? So I lived in Chicago for a while, during that process. And I think I had 17 pre-draft workouts and my name was all over the board. I think the earliest, honestly, I probably could have felt I would have gone would have been about the 16-17 mark, where I think the Wizards had a pick and they ended up taking Juan Dixon. I know I had two workouts with the Wizards. They liked me a lot, but I ended up going with Juan and no, he had a good career. Ironically, the Hawks never worked me out. They didn't have a first round pick. So they didn't think I was going to be an option for them, but even though they really liked me. So the day of the draft, things get going at my parents' house, kind of have a party. You know, there's quite a few people there, news crews and different things. And, you know, you start paying closer attention once you get to about 15, 16, because that's okay. You're starting to open up into the window you think you might go. And every draft, something happens. A guy goes way higher than expected, or a European guy that really nobody that are putting together all these mock drafts really know goes. And it kind of sends some changes in other organizations' depth charts. Okay, well, that now we're not going here. This guy's still available, and it just changes things. So I became kind of the guy who started to slide, because a lot of the teams in that next little grouping of selections they either had two point guards already on their roster, or you know, they had already had promises to other guys in the draft, whether it was a big or a wing or whatever. And so started getting a little concerned, a little worried, go out in the backyard and shoot a little bit, clear my mind. And this whole time I'm staying in touch with my agent, kind of talking to him about
Did you still have the three hoops? Did you still have the three hoops?
No, because at this point we were living in Vancouver. My parents lived in Vancouver, not in Portland. Good memory. I like it. So we were staying in touch with my agent throughout. And he said, look, I don't know a lot of what some of these other teams are going to do. They're playing it close, but I do know that Atlanta is doing everything they can to get a first round pick. And I said, Atlanta, I never worked out there. He goes, yeah, they wanted to bring you in, but we never did it because they didn't have a first round pick. Well, now it looks like there's an opportunity for them to select you. They're trying to make a pick. And so that happened from, like, I want to say draft selection number 21 on. And so finally the 28th pick with the Kings in Sacramento, the Kings agreed to make that trade and make that selection of me. So it was a fun day. It was exhilarating because you hear your name called by David Stern. But it was a very stressful day because you have no idea what's happening.
Your first welcome to the NBA moment was what?
Summer League. I got in a fight in the game with Richard Jefferson. I set a back pick on him. He didn't like it. He kind of tackled me on the back screen because he had complained that I was setting a number of other screens before in the game. So he kind of tackles me on the back screen, and we both get tossed. I think that was my second Summer League game back in Boston. But I think the first one would have been the first true NBA road trip. Rookies have to go do something for vets or the equipment manager. And mine on the first trip was I had to go put everybody's equipment bag outside their door about an hour before the bus left for Shooter on that morning. So I'm wide-eyed rookie. I was like, all right, I'll knock on everybody's door, make sure they, you know, have their gear. Well, go through about half of them, and I get to Big Dog Glenn Robinson's room, and I knock on the door, and there's no answer, and I knock on the door, and stupid me, I should have just dropped it on the hallway and walked away. Door opens, and some chicks in there. I'm like, I double check my list on, like, who's in what room. And because I know Glenn's, you know, he lives in Atlanta, he's single, whatever. And I'm confused at this point. And she's like, can I help you? I'm like, is Glenn here? She's like, who's Glenn? I say, Big Dog. and so I hear Big Dog from around the corner. Oh, just leave my gear right there. So I dropped the gear. I walked away. And the rest of the year, whenever I had to do equipment like that, all I would do is drop the gear on the floor, knock one time, and walk away. Rest of it was on them to make sure they had their gear.
I had – here's a story. I'm not going to – it was with the Bulls, right? I'm watching The Last Dance, right? So Corey Williams was a first-round draft pick from Oklahoma State, and he tells – and they called him Peanut. And because he was a rookie with those teams, Peanut, he didn't have any money for the gambling, so he held the money. That was his job, his year with the Bulls. He held the money. But he tells the story that when he was a rookie, he was just basically there, you know, whatever they needed, they would call him at any hour, like, yo, Peanut, I need this. Peanut, I need that. Peanut, come to my room. Peanut, whatever. So he gets a call to go get some protection for one of the veteran players. And he knocks on the door. Nobody answers. He knocks on the door. He's about to, same thing. He's about to leave it. The door opens. It's his teammate. He's got a hockey mask on, got a hockey stick, and nothing else. Thanks, Peanut. Grabs the bag, closes the door. So, a little different than yours, but there's some similarities there. You're born, grew up in Portland, then to Vancouver. What was the first, you get to play for the Portland Trailblazers twice, but what was that like? I mean, for a guy who played against Portland Trailblazers at the Green Valley Athletic Club, right? To now be playing for the Portland Trailblazers. There's a lot of cool things in your career.
Yeah.
I'd have to imagine that's the coolest.
No, it was unbelievable. And I think, you know, and actually I always kind of answer a similar question in the way that I'm that kid who kind of not only reached their dream, but like the ultimate dream. Like, yeah, I always wanted to play in the NBA, but I really wanted to play for the Blazers. And I did it twice, like you mentioned, but I also did it a third time as a coach. So I actually can kind of flip it and say, I'm the only kid who reached their goal three times, but then got fired three times because they traded me as a player twice and fired me as a player development coach when the new staff with Terry Stotts came in. But I remember it was leading into All-Star break, my second year in the NBA, where my minutes were up and down, fluctuating in Atlanta. I didn't fit Terry Stotts' eye as a backup point guard, so I didn't know what to expect. But in the first half of my last game in Atlanta, I played really well. And I didn't get in the second half. And I get in the car, and I'm pissed. Like, I mean, my wife actually told this story to somebody a little bit ago. I'm like unbelievably ticked off because I should have gotten the second half. Like, why the hell didn't I not play? This is dumb, right? And then I get a phone call about an hour after I get home late that night in Atlanta, and it was Billy King, the GM of the Hawks, and he said, Dan, I just wanted to let you know we've traded you. I'm like, okay. He's like, I'm sure you wanted to – you should have played in the second half, but you didn't know what was going on. We also traded Sharif Abdul-Rahim and Theo Ratliff with you to Portland. And I just lost it. I'm like, Portland, what? Are you serious? And he said, we couldn't play you in the second half because if you would have gotten hurt, the deal would have been blown up. It would have been off the table. But he said, if Sharif or Theo didn't play, everybody knew something was up. So those two had to play. And he said they were like sitting there on pins and needles, hoping that neither one of those guys got hurt. And so that night, my wife and I literally pulled an all nighter packing to get back home and going back to Portland. It was awesome.
What do you remember about putting on that jersey for the first time?
Well, I remember the press conference where they kind of announced the three of us and brought myself and Theo and Sharif in front of the media. And I think it was like at 3 p.m. or something like that. I'm so excited. I get there at like 1:30. Like, I'm like, hey, you know, traffic's getting really bad in Portland these days. I don't want to be late. And I was so early. Like, I didn't know what to do. But then, you know, the fact of getting that jersey on was awesome. I mean, I remember the first practice, like literally, I probably smiled the whole practice long, even though we were with a bunch of dudes that year that, you know, if you smile, they'd be like, what the hell's wrong with you? You know, I mean, we had an interesting group in Portland. That's for sure.
What is that? What is that like though? Because when you got there, that was kind of the end of the Jailblazers era. Right. And, yeah. You know, and so what is that like to be, you go into a culture and, you know, I know Reef really well. Like, he's a good, really smart dude. Theo's a great defensive player, right? Like, they bring in three solid guys. What is that like to now you're in a, you know, I don't know what Atlanta was like, but it is a different vibe there. What was that experience like?
Well, you're right in the fact that it was at the end of that quote unquote Jailblazers era. I mean, Rashid kind of had run his welcome in Portland. And so he played one game in Atlanta before then they shipped him on to Detroit and he ended up winning a title with the Pistons. But, you know, they had also traded Bonzi Wells who, you know, had some issues with people in the Portland area and the media. But when you look at the other guys that were still there, Damon is a guy that I knew going back to since right out of high school, and he was always supportive of me, and he mentored me to a certain extent in our time in Portland. You know, and I thought he got a bad rap in Portland for being a part of some of the things. I mean, he's doing a tremendous job as a college coach now. You know, but I think the two biggest interesting guys that we had on those Portland rosters were Ruben Patterson and Zach Randolph. I mean, Zach played against him in college. And I always found him to be, a nice guy, but he could also be steered, in the wrong directions if you didn't have great leaders around him. He became a great leader by the end of his career because he was around enough good guys that he kind of really truly learned the way. And then Ruben Patterson was interesting because I always seemed to be in a game with him at the same time because of how rotations work. And I swear to you, you've played with guys before that they'll tell you they're open the whole entire possession.
Yes.
And it was like every possession, like I'm bringing a ball down the floor. He's barking at me. I'm open. It was like, dude, chill. He'd break out of a play. Like, you know, Mo Cheeks would call whatever it is, you know, horns twist. And, you know, he's supposed to be in one spot and point guard brings over here and comes back off. And, you know, he saw something. So he broke out of the play and he ducked in and into the post. And if you didn't throw it to him, you're running back down court and he's hollering at you. You know, that was just Ruben. I mean, it was interesting. That's for sure.
When you popped your Achilles, like it takes a lot for a 6 foot white dude to make it in the NBA. And you kind of, you know, you're with the Celtics, you pop your Achilles. Is there, based upon what you did, there was no defeatist mindset, right? But was there a moment where you're sitting there and you're looking at your leg and you're like, maybe that's it?
No, there wasn't, to be honest with you, because I had issues with my Achilles for a couple of years leading up until when I popped it. I was seeing, you know, I had what was called an Ocitron therapy on my Achilles a year and a half prior. I had gone through a number of different things to kind of alleviate pressure and tension and help my Achilles feel as good as it could. And oddly enough, the day that I tore it, I felt as good as I had in years at pregame warmups. And I even told our trainer, Eddie Lassert with the Celtics, I said, dude, I feel great today. Whatever we're doing rehab-wise, we need to keep going with it. Lo and behold, first half, catching an outlet pass, take two steps and pop. Thought somebody stepped on my heel. Took another step. Oh man, somebody must not have stepped on me. Nobody's around me. Took another one. I was like, okay, this isn't right. I can't move. And so I passed it. I went down on the floor and you know, they don't want to tell you it's torn until you get back into the locker room, but you kind of know, you know, like, hey, no one's around you. I've been having issues. This something's going on. And even back in the locker room Eddie didn't want to say, hey, it's torn, until we got the MRI the next day back in Boston. But I, oddly enough, I, not once did I think that was the end of my career. Not once did I sit there and cry. You know, it hurt like crazy, especially once we got onto the flight home and the pressurized cabin was just unbearable. But you know, it was one of those things where I thought to myself, well, here's another thing I have to overcome in my career. And I think one of the things I'm most proud of is once I returned from mm-hmm. that injury, I never missed another practice or game because of my Achilles.
When you watch how Trae Young plays now, and Trae, I think, like, look, Steph has been able, and he's incredible at it, but he's been able to kind of break through a barrier of, like, what's a good shot, right?
Yeah.
Now, you know, and I mean, shots he takes, and then obviously Damian Lillard, the distance that he's shooting, there's, I'd have to think, based upon your ability to shoot, play off ball screens, to do all the things that those guys can do, I have to think there's a little bit of a, dude, I was born like 10 years too soon, right? Is there any of, because the sport has really changed, and what coaches allow in terms of shot selection has changed. And part of it is these guys make a percentage where you're like, look, that used to be a bad shot, but if you're going to make, you know, 45% of them from three, then fuck it, what am I to do? Is there a part of you that looks and watches and goes like, I was just born too soon?
Yeah, occasionally. You know, you watch the game and just see how free-flowing it is and the ability to shoot deep threes in transition and how many ball screens are happening in the space that's on the floor. And also, you know, quite frankly, the fact that a lot of games, the emphasis on defense isn't what it was when I was coming into the NBA. You know, but at the same time, I can't complain too much because I had a tremendous run. I had an opportunity to play in the NBA and achieve a goal and a dream. But I will say this, my rookie year, I had knee surgery, a scopa meniscus. I missed, you know, 6 weeks or so. In that time, Lon Kruger gets fired. Terry Stotts comes in as a head coach. Terry Stotts, we ran a lot of ISOs for Glenn Robinson. We ran a lot of cross-screen actions to bring Sharif to the block. We ran a lot of what's called hawk cuts.
Hawks
on the strong side and then get to a second side action. Yeah. And his message to me was this: you're my backup point guard. And this was my rookie year. And then the second year before I got traded to the Portland Trailblazers, who oddly enough, he's with the Blazers now and his system's completely different. But
yes,
his message to me as a backup point guard was this: if our team is up by four, when you go in, if when I check you back out, you're not up, we're not up four, the blame is on you.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what? That makes no sense. But that was his message. And then the next part of his message was, I want my backup point guard to pick up 94 feet and only take open shots. And I'm like, that's not my game. So because that's what he wanted, and because that wasn't my game, my rookie year they went out and signed Jacques Vaughn as their backup point guard to Jason Terry,
who all he does is facilitate and guard 94 feet.
And so, you know, that's where I think a lot of people are like, "Oh, you didn't do this or that when you're in."
No, they don't understand. I got a quick story for you. So my son's 11, and so one day after a game about 3 months ago, I sat these kids down and I explained to them what plus minus was, right? And I said, like, look, the two most important stats in basketball are kind of related. One is what the score is and what your personal plus minus is. Like, all the other stuff I care about, you know, but I don't care about.
Sure.
It's like, does the team do better with you in the game than when you're not in the game? So the true story, I swear to God. So Sunday night. My son is playing. We have a seventh grade group and he's in six. He's a young sixth grader and he's like the backup point guard. And I added some of the sixth graders to show him, because the seventh graders is there's a big jump between the two ages in terms of skill level, ability to run an offense, to physicality and bodies and all that stuff. So I wanted them to see kind of what it looks like. So we played a team and we could have beat them by 100 if I wanted to press or whatever, but I just wanted them to play good basketball, run offense, play man-to-man press, and just guard somebody, right? And we didn't play very well. I think we end up winning by like 12, and we had beaten the same team by like 35 the last time we played them, and we didn't have even our best players. So we have an hour in between games, and he's really down, really down. And so, you know, with COVID, you can't stay in the gym. So you're better off. It was cold outside. Let's just go in the car. So we go in the car, and I was like, what is the matter with you? Dad, my plus minus was terrible. I was like, what? I went into the game. We're up 16. I come out of the game. We're up 13. I was like, look, you just learned a very valuable lesson. Okay. Don't tell anybody I told you this, but plus minus can be a little bit of bullshit because you actually, there's nothing, you didn't turn the ball over. You know, you missed a shot, but it was a good shot. Like it was a shot.
Yeah.
You played defense. You did everything I want. Like I didn't, well, am I mad at you? Then I get on to him when he's like, anyway, he was like, my plus minus was just terrible. Anyway, played really well the second game, but the plus minus thing is fascinating. And the 94 feet thing is fascinating because guys are so locked in their head for what you're supposed to be instead of trying to figure out what you can be, right? Like what you can.
Yes.
Be. Okay. Couple quick ones. Then I want to get to GU. I want to get to a couple other things business-wise for you. First, coolest dude that you play with in the NBA that people wouldn't know this guy is an awesome guy or just the greatest?
Well, Scalabrine is the easy one because he's so personable and he's in the media now. And he's a Washington guy, so we had a lot of connections before, teammates in Boston. You know, I think, you know, for me, I was only in Dallas for a short bit, but Dirk Nowitzki is the real deal. He is a great dude. Unbelievable. I mean, great leader, great teammate. He's got the greatest work ethic. He's unbelievably loyal, obviously, by staying with Dallas all those years. And like I said, I was only there a short bit, but about 2 years ago, I went back. I was in Dallas for a broadcast and I was at SMU. But during the morning, I went to the Mavericks to go facility to watch practice. And I was sitting there with Donnie Nelson, just kind of talking basketball for 40 minutes or so. And then practice is over and Dirk comes over and we just talk for like 15 minutes. And I hadn't seen Dirk in a long time. You know, we were teammates for a few months is all, but that really impressed me. Like, you know what? That was awesome.
Have you ever seen anything like his shooting routine with his shooting coach? You ever like that thing? I've seen videos of it.
Oh yeah. And it's real. I mean, I know people see those videos and they're like, oh, he doesn't do that all the time. No, he does that all the time. You know, the rolling hooks, the roll the ball out and kind of the deep knee bend into his shots, how he works on that one-legged fadeaway. All that stuff. It's almost a daily routine for him.
Best coach you played for in the NBA?
You know, I mean, it's so indicative of how you were successful. So for me, Byron Scott was great because I was able to play a lot, but it's because the system he ran, the Princeton offense, I could read and read screens and react to it. I could understand it and I could influence the offense to a certain extent. If I wanted a shot, okay, I'm going to throw the ball there and come off this screen. You know, so that would have been good. Mike
so Dunn, elbow maybe, or I chin, think. Elbow or chin, which is your preference?
I might, if I wanted to pick and roll, I'm going chin. I'm throwing the ball to the other two guard and telling him, hey, bring it up and run chin 15. Otherwise, elbow, you know, I really liked. And then Mike Dunleavy was a basketball savant to me. Like every action on the court, whether it's a down screen, an up screen, a back screen, a cross screen, has a number attached to it. And like, say, a cross screen is a 12, a down screen is a 6. If he wants to screen the screener action, it's an 18, so it's 12 plus 6. Just unbelievable basketball mind.
Huh. You have any regrets to your NBA career?
No, I really don't. You know, I think if there was one, it would be shoot more. You know, I mean, if you look at it, sometimes maybe I did get kind of bogged down in being a true teammate, in trying to do what was asked of me by the coaching staff to run a play, as opposed to occasionally be a little bit more, you know, selfish and looking for my own shots. But at the same time, you know, not everybody has the opportunities to, or the freedom to break out. Because what if I broke out and I missed a shot? Well, guess what? I was probably coming back to the bench. There's very few guys in the NBA that really have the freedom that most people think that they have.
Yeah, I do. I do. One of the things I really enjoyed about professional basketball is when you saw somebody and you knew he was coming to get you, you were getting a shot up, and kind of everybody knew that was happening, right? Like, you see the guy checking in for you, like,
or if you're at the free throw line, you miss it on purpose.
Yeah, because the guys are going to come get for you. Dan Dickhouse made 17 free throws. Wow, he just missed one. That's the announcer jinx. Like, no, man, they're about to take him out. That's exactly what happened. GU this year is going to take on Iowa this weekend. We think. First, this GU squad. Now, what fans do is they always compare them to old GU squads, right? But they don't actually play each other. The landscape of the sport is so incredibly different, right? Having seen them far more than anybody else, obviously not able to get to practice as much because of COVID, but now seeing them, what are your thoughts on in mid-December on the squad?
Tremendous balance. You know, a lot of people were kind of curious what was going to happen in the front court with Petrushev leaving. Yeah, that's a big loss, but it also is a big opportunity that's opened up for Timmy, and he's been tremendous the first few games of the year. Do I want to see one of the other young bigs, either Balo or Zakharov, improve? Absolutely. And one of those two guys is going to have to play and play well against Garza with Iowa, because he's a monster. But if you look at the rest of the GU kind of rotation, I mean, Kispert's done what so many Gonzaga players have done before, just gradually improve over your course of time. And then once it becomes – you become a bigger focal point of everything, which was about maybe midway through last year, and now he obviously is this year, you're ready for it. And he's absolutely ready for it. I mean, his games, you know, continue to improve. His leadership is absolutely there. Same thing with Ayi, continues to show growth. But everybody's getting excited, and rightfully so, for Suggs. You know, he's coming in to Gonzaga with such high expectations. You know, top five national recruit. Gonzaga's never had a top 30 national recruit, and now you're getting Suggs. I mean, he plays at his own pace. He's very athletic, but he plays at his own pace, and he plays with kind of a sense of control in him that's basically just showing people that I'm in charge. I've got this. You know, there's a lot of times you're really good, you're really athletic, and you try to force the action. And I haven't seen that out of him yet. And you take a freshman, your first game against Kansas and against a great defender in Garrett, and you put up the numbers that he had, whatever it was, like 22 points or whatever. That's a great start to your college career. The biggest thing, I think, for Gonzaga, I think this year will be is how consistent a play can they get from the four. You know, Anton Watson had battled injuries last year. I think he's got a chance to be a really good player there. How quickly can he kind of get back to the level that he was last season early before he got hurt? Because he's versatile, he can stretch the floor as a four. He can get out and guard anybody. He can run in transition. So I think that four is going to be interesting to see how well he improves, as well as do one of the other young bigs that I mentioned improve enough where, you know, Timmy can also slide in occasionally at the four.
Okay. So they're going to play Iowa, and I know you've seen them, and it's like, there has to be from Gonzaga fans, like, wow, they're kind of like we used to be, maybe a little bit like dudes that are all skilled. Right. Yeah. All skilled. I mean, like, Garza is a scoring machine, obviously. Bohannon is he's not what you were. He's not the passer of Blake, but the dude can stripe it. You know, Wieskamp is, he looks, there's a lot of guys they have that kind of feel like Zags. They just do to me. I don't know. Is that a crazy I don't in any way want to offend a Zag, but because this is more me secondhand, but that's what it feels like in watching them.
No, I think that's a great observation. I think the thing for people that have, you know, paid close attention to college basketball over the years, like yourself, one of the first things that comes to mind for Gonzaga players, and whether it's perimeter or interior, is they're skilled. They've got to have great footwork. They've got to have the ability to finish underneath if you're a big with either hand. Have an abundance of moves down there on the perimeter. You're going to have to be a serviceable, if not a really good outside shooter, and make the right plays. And when you look at those Iowa guys that you just mentioned, they check a lot of those same boxes. And so I see a lot of the same similarities that you mentioned.
You have like all this, you have a ton of business stuff going on, right? Like you got your barbershops, you have your pod, you're doing broadcasting.
Life's busy.
It is busy. You're a parent, obviously, but I also know when you love ball and you've coached ball, it's a drug, man. It's really, really hard to, you're kind of all, it's like I tell people, you're always an addict, right? That's what they tell you about real addicts, like drug addicts. You're kind of always a hoop addict. Is what you're doing now, does that fulfill that need, or is there ultimately going to be a need to be a coach?
Great question. You know, my wife and I have talked about the coaching thing before, and you know, I've over the last 5-6 years, I've had a couple colleges reach out for assistant coach positions. I've had an NBA organization reach out on a player development position. I would never say no to an opportunity to coach until I hear more about it. But I do know with all the things that I'm doing with the businesses of the barbers that you mentioned and the broadcasting and my work with SB Live, which is where, you know, my main podcast runs 3 times a week. And I do a number of other things with them. That's where my time and attention goes right now. And I know how much of a time demand and a drain it can be on coaches for themselves, but as well as you know, their families. But none of that does fulfill the chance to be part of a win or a loss. And you get that as a coach. Now, I don't think it's necessarily the same as a player. And I don't think they're meant to be the same because you have different roles within that. But I think the biggest thing that the broadcasting does and that I appreciate about it is I stay as close to the game as I can without having to take the game home with me all the time. You know, like, for example, I've already done 5 Pac-12 games this year. I've got probably 6 or 7 more on that network. I've got about 20 games coming up on CBS Sports Network in addition to the Gonzaga regional games. So I talk to enough coaches throughout the year to get my basketball fix, and I'm around it enough without taking it home with me, if that makes sense.
It does. I think, though, the other part that you discussed, though, is the hard part, which is there is no win, there is no loss, right? And you almost miss the losses as much as the wins, because then it becomes the jigsaw puzzle of, all right, how do we fix the problem, right? Whereas I've told coaches this all the time. Like, look, if you don't want to coach again, don't call a game. Because if you call a game, especially back when you're in the arenas, you go to practice, you're around it, you're like, you so badly want to grab a whiteboard and just go like, do this. I swear to God, this will work. Right. And you get done and you just miss the highs and the lows. It's very, very hard. And I told Urban Meyer this when he was at ESPN, he did the games. And I was like, dude, I knew you were going back. Now he's in studio at Fox. And I think he might be done, because there's the second you step foot into a locker room or you're on the sideline for a big one and you feel the pain and the agony of losing the absolute joy, like a road win. Dude, you call a game and a team in a tough environment figures out a way to win a close one on the road. You're like, God, I wish I was on that flight home. I wish I was a part of that. Cause that's like the most magical thing in our sport, right? Which is the feeling of a road win. So yeah. And then when you coach, like I coached a team you coach kids, or I coach a team in Israel. You think that'll fulfill the need, but that only makes it worse, right? Because now you're like, yeah, I love it. I want more. I want more. I want more. So I do wonder if at some point, and here's a thing I get that you and I don't work in the film rooms and with the staff, but don't you feel more knowledgeable having watched a bunch of other teams practice as opposed to sitting on one bench and figuring out one way of doing things?
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, Coach Few and I have even had a number of conversations about coaching. And, you know, he has a certain set of, I don't want to call them guidelines, but things that he likes to see his coaching staff members having gone through to be able to kind of be a part of his staff. And that's his right. He's earned that ability to kind of pick and choose what he wants his coaching staff's experiences to look like. But Adam Morrison and I have talked about this on a number of times. Like, when you play in the NBA and you've had to have the IQ that he and I had to have, and you had to have the competitiveness and the skills, and then you go through an NBA career where you're going through film sessions, you're going through shoot-arounds, you're going through practices, you're going through pre-game meetings, you've earned a PhD in the game of basketball. You know, at the NBA level, because you're looking at 82 games times 82 scouting reports times 82 shoot-arounds times another 60 practices. That's 2.5 college years seasons in one. And I get it, and I know that at the college level there's a huge emphasis on the recruiting part, which comes with the territory. You know, but I liken it to, you know, when you've been around something for so long, you've seen it all. I mean, maybe I don't have a specific philosophy towards this thing or that thing at this moment in time, but I can go back. If I were placed in a situation where I had to really think about it or put it together, I could go back quickly through my memory banks and figure out, okay, hey, that's what we did in this situation. I liked that, or I didn't like that. You know, and then I also did, when I did think I was going into coaching, I did put together philosophy books as far as defense and offense and what I wanted to do if I were ever in that position. But I haven't looked at those in a good 10 years or so since the Blazers fired me that third time.
Last thing, you mentioned player development. You know, you have your kids your own, and they want to be a player. You know, we see so many one-on-cone guys and workout guys and whatever. If you were to grab, and I'm sure you've done this with your own son, but you say, hey, look, this is what it takes to make it. What would it be?
You know, the trainers, it is what it is. You're going to see lots of that nowadays, and there's lots of money in it for trainers to make the money. And I'm not faulting them at all. Because if there's an opportunity that you can provide a service, go for it. I have an issue when I see trainers doing what you just talked about, one-on-one stuff with cones. I've seen trainers that have set out 50 cones and it's like a zigzag drill. And then you pick up a medicine ball, toss it in one hand while you finish it, a layup with the other. That makes no sense, because you will never do that on a basketball court. When I put my son and his friends and teams, or I put workouts together in Spokane, I've had parents say, why are you doing that? Well, you have to be able to handle the ball. You have to have footwork. You have to be able to shoot it. And then you have to understand the game of how do those things tie into basketball specific situations. Pick and roll. Okay, you got to make pick and roll reads. So come off pick and roll with the handle, make the pass, or get your footwork right into a shot. Same thing if you're coming off a down screen, or if you're spacing it, or if you're a postman, catch it, you know, reverse pivot face, all those different things that, you know, I think are so undervalued and undertaught as opposed to the flashy fun stuff. I go back to the comment all the time. I think basketball is over coached and undertaught.
It's a great way to look at it. We got a big tournament this weekend. I got two practices the next 2 days. And, you know, my son's like, Dad, why do we do that? The passing and the footwork stuff, like, can't we play more? And I was like, no, you'll play this weekend, but you'll play better if you do the passing and the cutting and the footwork stuff. Trust me. Trust me. The dribbling stuff, like, it's great. You know, like I I'm he's like big on going through his legs. You know how many times I went through my legs when I played professional basketball? Hardly at all. I went one way, and if I didn't like that, I went the other way. It's kind of that simple. And if they back up, you shoot or you pass the ball. It is crazy. Very last thing is this. If Gonzaga wins the whole thing, because they gotten close and you were a part of the build phase of making it into the national brand. You, as you said, you were still kind of, what would it mean to you if these guys won it, in terms of just how do you think it would feel to you for them to win that final game?
Tremendous amount of pride, you know. Each group that had special teams or in teams that felt like they could have been the team to win a national title. Do we probably have disappointment and wish that it would have been us? Absolutely, without a doubt. But it won't take away any amount of pride that we have for being a part of the building blocks of the program. And I don't think it will take away any of our excitement for the current group if they're able to get it done. Because again, what Gonzaga basketball has become over the last 20 to 25 years is something that is truly special. And the only thing left is a national title.
It's true. It's the only thing left. Well, you guys built it, and it's out of supreme amount of respect that I asked you to come on. I appreciate it. Love watching what you're doing with broadcasting. And I can't tell you how gracious you've been with your time. Thanks, man.
Absolutely. Thanks, Doug. I appreciate it. And we'll have to have you on my ISO podcast again. I know you've been on once. At some point, we'll get you on a second time.
Literally, dude, anytime. Anytime.
Awesome. Thanks again, Doug.
All right, brother. See you. Man, so many good parts there to Dan's story. If you listen, clearly he wants to. He loves to coach. He loves ball. And I love that those Gonzaga guys take great pride still in who's playing, wearing what we consider their uniform. It's one of the great things about when you play, you know, play to college. And he only played there 2 years. It's also fascinating to me how, you know, and this is more a double transfer thing or transfers in general. You lose most all contact and association with that first school. And so if you're going to transfer out, understand you're kind of out of the family. That's kind of part of the deal. But that guy made himself into a tremendous college basketball player and played enough in the NBA. I mean, you play one day in the NBA, that's enough for me. He played long enough in the NBA to just have great stories, great memories. And I really hope you enjoyed that kind of trip down a little bit of memory lane. Dan is a fantastic analyst as well, and somebody who I enjoy his kind of unique perspective and a guy who's a basketball guy. And I think that one of the things that us basketball guys do, and if you're listening to this, you probably are too. You struggle to how the rest of the world sees the sport. You got to kind of relay it. And I think he did a great job. So hope you enjoyed that. That's a 2-part episode. If you missed part one, you should download that. It's why he went to Washington, his upbringing, all kinds of different stuff. And remember to listen to Doug Gottlieb Show, 3-6 Eastern, 12-3 Pacific, Fox Sports Radio, iHeartRadio app, or foxsportsradio.com. You can also download that as a podcast. Subscribe, download, subscribe, rate, write a review. Just do it. It takes a couple seconds. It ends up helping us out. And tell a friend about this. Tweet it out. You like it, you don't like it. I thought it was a great discussion. That's a lot of meat to chew on as you're driving around. Have a safe and Merry Christmas. A Happy New Year. We'll keep pumping out these all balls. If you guys have guests you want to hear, there's things you like, tweet quotes. There's been incredible response to this podcast from so many of my friends in basketball. Enjoy it. Enjoy the hoops. We'll talk soon. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.